This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good morning, I'm Sharad Kutan, and it's time for the show that gets to the stories behind the headlines. My guest today is Ken Wong. He's a journalist based somewhere in the world. Of course, he's well known for many interesting platforms in Malaysia, including the Malaysian Men's Review many years ago. Thank you so much for joining us this morning, Ken.
No problem.
Okay, so we're going to be looking at the business of the media. And I think in that regard, you know, you have quite a bit of experience. You've reported for on the business of media for the ABC, that's the Australian Broadcasting Corporation, the BBC, and various newspapers since Rupert Murdoch bought into Hong Kong Star TV and the onset of commercialized web in the 1990s. It's that you're that old, apparently.
Unfortunately so. I've been accused of being a fossil, I think.
Yeah, I take a complete blame for that. Okay, let's begin with this very interesting story, Ken. We're going to tweet out the link to it, which is an article in BuzzFeed entitled How the Guardian Lost America. It was written by Stephen Pearlberg, and he's a BuzzFeed news reporter, and looked at how the Guardian moved over to the US. So he started a branch, but it didn't start a bureau. It actually tried to do its own thing. And I believe Guardian has an Australian edition as well.
The new editor of the Guardian worldwide, centered in, you know, London, Kath Viner, actually, you could say, very successfully created the Guardian Australia first. And I guess that helped vault her eventually to the top job via America, where she went.
Right, after. And because there's so much drama in the story that's told by Pearlberg, but there's some issues that perhaps lessons we can all learn, right?
Yes.
Including, maybe we could begin with the whole issue of identity. So you have Guardian, it's a very strong brand in Britain. Of course, it reports about the world, but for a British audience. Mm. It seems kind of slightly left of center, at least on economic and social welfare issues. It goes to America at a time when, I think it's 2013, you know, and there are all these changes happening in the US. Do you remember from the article, what was the thinking behind The Guardian? They moved to America thinking that it would be a great, not just an editorial opportunity, but a business proposition as well.
It had to be entirely a business proposition, because the thing about The Guardian is that, at least with its previous model of being avowedly entirely free under the previous editorial director and long-standing editor and legend in his own lifetime, Alan Ruspiger, was that, you know, they had to create audience and volume. And in fact, they had millions of readers. And they did very well in America, the unprecedented foreign publication winning a Pulitzer.
And this was the Edward Snowden thing.
Exactly.
Yes.
So it really broke big. And from there, they obviously, I think, quite cogently decided, you know, it was a good place to go. I mean, maybe, you know, I mean, drawing from my own sort of experience working for The Economist before, I mean, we always were told, at least, you know, amongst, you know, discussion among colleagues at The Economist and all that, how, you know, more than half of The Economist's business, so to speak, circulation, readership, advertising, comes from the U.S., The U.S. is like this huge, highly competitive, actually brutally competitive marketplace, but at the same time, great potential for things like The Guardian.
Right. So this is where business also meets editorial. What exactly was The Guardian going to do in the U.S.? It was not going to be a foreign outpost of The Guardian UK. It was going to be its own thing. There was this issue of how did they follow, for instance, the U.S. presidential election campaign, right? And there's a lot of hand-wringing here about having dropped Bernie Sanders and, you know, them actually going with the herd and ultimately not doing anything new. Mm. And then there's a question of breadth and depth. You know, do you focus on some things, you know, distinguish yourself from the New York Times and all the other American media outlets, or do you kind of mimic them and try to play games game on their side, which then necessitates scale. Scale necessitates huge amounts of money.
That's right. And that seems to be the, you know, conundrum that The Guardian itself really now faces. I mean, it effectively runs off the Scots Trust, which had been a £1 billion patrimony. And it's a great way to ensure editorial independence, but they've been burning through the pounds or dollars at a phenomenal rate, to the extent that all sorts of, you know, doomsayers are saying, God, at this rate, you know, the Guardian will be finished, gone, bankrupt within the next 20 years, which is amazing. But part of the problem, I think, is that this part where you go into a very competitive marketplace like America, where everyone, you know, flicks through media, you know, like confetti, and then what you end up having is that if you are not distinctive enough, if you did not capitalize on what sort of made your name through the Snowden revelations, how are you any different from those with much deeper roots in America, like the Washington Post or the New York Times, or even the so-called second-rung papers like the LA Times, which did great sort of coverage during the 2016 campaigns?
You know, what is also needs to be said is that Guardian US was entirely digital. It didn't have a print version, which is what the Guardian UK has. But this landscape, the digital landscape, because it relates to what we're going to be talking about after the break, which is because the Reuters Institute's digital news report 2017, was that there are all these real problems, including the fact that Google and Facebook has a dominant in that area, and there's this problem of ad blocking software, and how do you get over it? And I believe that one of the things that the Guardian did was to say, well, if you do have ad blocking software, what you could still do is donate to us. And so they've moved into kind of a donation mode, haven't
they? That's right. And that's something that they claim has been quite successful in the hundreds of thousands of those donating, like a subscription. But it's not as reliable as a subscription, and you can't quite predict, I think, your revenue streams 8, 12 months down the track, which is what is necessary. And I mean, talking to colleagues and, you know, acquaintances that I know when I lived in Washington until Trump came along, I mean, there has been this huge sort of subset of wonky sort of blogs, news sites like Talking Points Memo and so on, who are all pivoting towards the subscriber model and less the advertising one, precisely because of the unpredictability of revenue streams and the fact that Facebook and Google gobble up more than half of all advertising available to these media sites. So subscribers, basically making people pay up for what they've enjoyed so far for ostensibly for free, is the only way forward for any sort of serious journalism outfit. And I think The Guardian maybe is also discovering that somewhat belatedly. But in the meantime, having burnt hundreds of millions of pounds in the process.
You know, just to note, there's some numbers here. The company, that is The Guardian, says it has some 230,000 paying members as of March this year. You know, it's a really daunting year. Think about Malaysia and think of the people in, you know, the organizations in the digital space, you know, the Malaysia Kinis, the Malaysian Insight, the Malay Mail Online, all of them also in this real difficult struggle to maintain both their identity and also, you know, commercial viability.
Exactly. And I think the big problem here is we come back down to maybe the backdrop of this, whether I think citizens themselves, whether in America or Britain or in Malaysia, actually consider free and valuable and information of integrity important enough to pay. If you don't pay for it, I mean, the old saying is, like Facebook, the product is you.
Yeah, and you know, Facebook is one of those platforms that now everybody's saying, well, you know, everything is delivered on these platforms, but where's the source? I mean, the stories come from somewhere, and somebody's got to pay for quality stories that will populate these platforms, don't they?
But that's exactly why people have complained about Facebook and Google in the, you know, Trump elections about fake news and so on. Precisely because you don't pay for it, there is no process of, you know, editorial sifting. You might get all sorts of information that may not be true.
Yeah. You know, the interesting thing, because The Guardian also had a debacle with one of their stringers who created fictional or fabricated stories. But of course, with the gatekeeping there, perhaps it was easier for them once they've discovered it to, you know, to deal with that problem.
All I can say about that, though, is that in many ways, Malaysia has trailblazed that way. I mean, we've done this a long time ago.
What, fabricated?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. We had various scandals. I remember at the Sun newspaper where I used to work, we had a few very wonderful fabrications from some colorful characters.
I think this is because available. In fact, there's, I believe, a movie that was based on this precise real-life event of a journalist working for a well-known American journal. I think it was a journal of ideas who also fabricated things, especially with the desire for more color stories and for a little bit of pizzazz. You know, so everything was slightly sexed up.
But the incentive is so much bigger now because of, you know, the advent of clickbait, the need to get traffic, how even media organizations are rating employees, you know, bonuses and wages based on how much clicks you have. So, you know, the incentive is huge to go and create more color, whether there's any color or not to be had.
Okay, you've been listening to Kian Wong. He's a veteran journalist. We're going to be back with the Reuters Institute's Reuters Institute for the Study of Journalism and its Digital News Report 2017. We'll be back with more. I'm Sharad Kutin, BFM 89.9. Good morning, I'm Sharad Kutin. This is Pressing Matters. My guest, Kian Wong, veteran journalist, former editor of Men's Review, also a contributor to The Economist, the BBC World Service Radio, and many other interesting, I think, moments in Malaysian journalism history. We're going to be looking, Kian, now at that report that you highlighted to me, which is the Reuters Institute for the Study of Journalism, I think based in Oxford, I believe. And they've produced a recent report called Digital News Report 2017. It's a hefty report, as reports go, something you can't tweet out. But there are many bits of it that strike you as one as very important to understand in terms of trends in media. We don't have to just talk about business trends, but what is it that struck you most in this report?
I think what struck me most about this report was that, one, the sustainability of doing journalism as opposed to the sustainability of making money from media. I think they become somewhat two distinct strands. Traditionally, with newspapers where I first started, too long ago, there used to be one product which you could say cross-subsidized the journalism. But now it's all been differentiated so much, a bit like AirAsia, where you have to pay for every little bit and it all adds up. But you don't have to pay for bits. And now people can choose not to pay for any of the journalism or verified information. And I think the backdrop to this Reuters report, which I think is quite bracing and challenging in many parts, is also a Pew Global Research recent surveys, one in Australia by the think tank Lowy Institute, which has found that the so-called millennial generation, people roughly under 35, are quite disinterested, disdainful, in fact, perhaps even antagonistic towards notions of democracy. They would much prefer what they consider societies that work. And invariably, what works might well be the sort of authoritarianism that China or even Russia represent. And I suppose that, I think, becomes the sort of friction that modern-day journalism needs to contend with. Because these are your so-called future audiences or current audiences that may not want to pay for so-called real news and might be very happy with the sort of platitudes that say fake news or, you know, other information gives you.
You know, so part of the, and I'm just looking at the executive summary now, it says the internet and social media may have exacerbated low trust and fake news, in inverted commas, but we find that in many countries, the underlying drivers of mistrust are as much to do with the deep-rooted political polarization and perceived mainstream media bias. So here it is, so people may be turned off from the media as a whole because of the specific practices of some media institutions. So, and I think this is something that perhaps we know happens in Malaysia, that because they've not been sufficiently critical, they've not been sufficiently independent, they've actually tainted the whole endeavor just for everybody, haven't they?
That's right. And I think the other thing that comes up quite a lot now, and this is not just specific to Malaysia, where, you know, I hear obviously being here regularly, you know, and knowing lots of people, gripes about the sort of political entity that is Malaysia and the notion of a nation that is Malaysia that is still being crafted and contested in many ways, is that it applies in Australia too, where I, you know, live now, and where I think a lot of people question why they are citizens, but they don't explicitly articulate it that way. And I think part of it is that maybe people need to be reminded that with all those rights that you have as a citizen, you know, the usual rights and responsibilities argument, that you also have some responsibilities. And maybe some of that responsibility includes being truthfully informed with integrity. But then how do you pay for that?
Right. I mean, just some numbers here, and this distinguishing social media from the mainstream press. Only a quarter of respondents think that social media do a good job in separating fact from fiction, compared to 40% who say that of the news media. So that's interesting. So there's more trust in traditional news media than there is of social media. The data also suggests that users feel the combination of a lack of rules and viral algorithms are encouraging low quality and fake news to spread quickly. So I think people, consumers, are conscious of what drives the media. They're no longer naive in consuming to some extent, though people continue to be naive. Maybe that's a good thing too. I mean, it's heartwarming to know people can be naive in this day and age. But so the study does suggest that people are aware that algorithms are driving much of what they see on their interface.
Yeah, I think it's that's why some interesting points in here. But I also wonder about the sort of generational breakdown that they may have. What younger people might think, what older people might think. I mean, like, the interesting, there's a chart in there where they look at the various mediums, radio, print, TV, online, social media, and so on. And you find that the traditional medias like newspapers, radio, TV to some extent, are all trending towards an older demographic.
Okay, that may be. Just also to note, and we talked about this, Ken, the other day you were at the Ilham Gallery when we recorded A Bit of Culture. It hasn't aired yet, but that episode, Cam Razan, who's the host, you know, picked up the question of, you know, whether you should read the news at all, get involved in it. And here we have some numbers that, according to the survey, 29% of people say they often or sometimes avoid the news. And they do this because it can have a negative effect on their mood.
Yes.
And so that's an interesting perspective as well. People are conscious that, you know, they want to remain happy, and maybe one way to remain happy is to avoid listening to the really harsher realities of global news, whether it's political or economic or social.
Well, that's why I think it relates to the broader reality now of the issue of how the world is about me. It's this individualized, atomized world where at the same time you it's correspond, I think, to those, you know, various polls where younger generations say, you know, we don't want a democracy. Because in a way, living in a democracy means you need to be necessarily engaged in a very civic or civil society sense.
Okay, so there's some good news, though, and in terms of, like, endeavours where, say, ad blocking might be, might stymie the possibilities of making money. Ad blocking growth has stalled, apparently, on desktops. It remains at a kind of 21%. It remains low on smartphones, and over half of those surveyed say they temporarily disable their ad blocker for news. In countries like Poland, where it's up to 57% of people would do that, they would temporarily unblock. Denmark and the United States, up to 50%. So they're allowing these news organizations to make a living, as it were, and, you know, and therefore the possibility of good journalism resulting.
Which is exactly why, though, that smaller sort of news sites that I'm familiar with in America that, you know, tackle a lot of politics and economics mostly, are pushing towards more subscriber or foundation sponsorship, because it is the only way forward now to sort of predict the sort of revenue stream that you need to hire teams of journalists. It is a real problem, I think, this question now about media. I mean, the distinction, I think, still needs to be made between media and journalism, that there is actually a sort of division now, which didn't really exist in traditional media before. How do you sustain it? How do you pay for it? And are people willing to pay for it? And this is the thing. I think in the era of Trump in America, and because Americans traditionally have always been in a way, forced to engage with the democracy, right down to elections for school boards, local counties, and so on. Otherwise, you don't get, you know, services. You have to run for elections to do these things. That they do that with media, and they've been fairly successful. But of course, the market's big enough where 50, 60,000 subscribers can sustain something. I think the question then arises in a place like Malaysia, are there enough people here to want to do that? And I think there's a real question as to, can Malaysia Kini, for instance, sustain that just partly based on, you know, grants and other investments?
You mentioned the question of hiring journalists there, because in the Guardian story we were talking about earlier, you know, it's quite terrifying, the numbers of people who were hired at the growth,
yes,
at the height,
right,
and then the numbers that were basically fired when the rationalization.
Not just Guardian Australia. One thing that we could talk about America, very just mention as well, Al Jazeera America, that went from, you know, 500 to zip. You know, it's amazing.
Yeah, it's terrifying for us journalists. Also, very quickly, in this executive summary, it mentions voice-activated digital assistants like Amazon Echo emerging as a new platform for news, already outstripping smartwatches in the US and the UK. I don't even know what Amazon Echo is. Do you, Ken?
It's sort of a house automation process.
And so what does it do? How does that link to media?
Well, you can put your preferences and you can serve up whatever you like.
Oh, wonderful. Okay. Thank you so much, Ken, for joining us this morning.
Thank you.
Is Ken Wong. He's a veteran journalist, also contributed to BFM. He's of course, contributed to us, but he's also was the editor of Men's Review and contributed to the BBC World Service and The Economist over the years. This has been Pressing Matters. I'm sure it couldn't. We're coming up to the news at 10 o'clock, and then after that, Enterprise. Stay tuned. BFM 89.9, the business station.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.